This is Radio Boston. I'm Yasmin Ammer in for Tiziana Deering. Today we're talking about the T. Oh, there's plenty to talk about. Partial shutdowns of multiple subway lines, looming financial problems, ongoing work to fix hundreds of slow zones. All this in a city where public transit is a vital part of economic and social life. Not to mention, it's a key piece of goals to decrease congestion and mitigate climate change. So here to break it all down, Stacy Thompson, executive director of the advocacy group Livable Streets. Thank you so much for being here, Stacy.
Thanks for having me.
We also have with us Brian Kane, executive director of the MBTA Advisory Board. That's a board made up of chief elected officials in every municipality the T serves, and they give input to the T on budget matters. Hi to you, Brian.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you as well. So in a little bit, I want to talk about the money underpinning all this because that's very important. But I do want to start with the current state of the T from a rider's perspective. Stacy, data show that the T is making progress in fixing slow zones. Those are areas with speed limits because the rails are old or need repair. So have things sped up enough to the point that riders can actually feel that improvement?
Unfortunately, no.
Okay.
So just by way of context, I am a T rider. I experience the slow zones every single time I get on the T. And the reality is we're looking at about a decade of not fixing tracks, right? So I think every time the T makes an announcement or says, you know, we fixed a slow zone here, a slow zone there, folks think they're going to feel something when in reality, I think we've got about a year of improvements before there's a measurable improvement. I do think that the governor has put in place the right team, which is exciting. If people haven't been paying attention, we have a new general manager, we have a new chief of safety, we have a new chair of the MBTA board, and a few new board members. That's a positive sign, but I think we're going to be having a bumpy summer.
We really have to make up for all the time we've lost, is what you're saying. It's
yes.
just been too...
Yeah. And it's not, again, it's both these capital, what we would call a capital project, meaning, you know, like actual hardware. But then there's also a manpower problem at the T. So even if every piece of rail were brand new overnight, we had the rail ferry come in, you know, wave their wand.
Please come, rail ferry.
we don't have enough dispatchers and operators right now
yes.
for the bus system, for the rail system. So it's a combination of those operating things, the actual people, with the capital stuff that's really created this crisis. So I would say the hopeful piece is every single one of these problems is fixable. We're not looking at a catastrophic problem. We're looking at too many problems happening at once, but they are fixable. So I think with the right team in place and the right funding, we could have a real marked improvement in 12 months.
I got you. And so there are a lot of subway line shutdowns coming over the course of this month to work on repairs. So that's, you know, part of the improvements that are happening that you just talked about. Brian, can you tell riders and people in general what their commutes could look like in the coming weeks?
It's going to be a very challenging summer and a very challenging May, as Stacy said. I think we're going to experience lots and lots of very slow trips, lots of diversions, folks getting transferred to shuttle buses. Hopefully, not in an emergency basis, but in a well-planned and orderly process. But it's going to be a real challenging month across all modes. There are just simply not enough bus drivers to move the folks that have to get moved, let alone to man the shuttles that have to get – you have to have drivers on them. So it's going to be a challenging time. I think people's patience is wearing a little bit thin. We've been told over and over again that we just have to do this one month shutdown, or we just have to do this one project and then things will be better, and they don't get better. So part of it is also the T has to get a lot better at expectation management and honesty and transparency with the riding public, because people, frankly, are starting to get a little sick of it.
Mm. So if you're just joining us, we are talking to Brian Kane, executive director of the MBTA Advisory Board. And joining us also is Stacy Thompson, executive director of Livable Streets. And we're talking about the T and everything that has to do with the T. But so when you said it's going to be a rough summer, it gave me a little bit of pause, because these aren't just, you know, people coming to work. This is a big tourism season, too. So, I mean, this is – sometimes I look over and I see, like, who are clearly visitors to Boston, and I just – I cringe a little bit because I'm thinking, oh, we're better than this. I promise. Come back and visit. But like, are you concerned about that? I want to know which lines will be most affected. And if you think it's going to, you know, affect our, you know, economic reality as a city this summer.
It's a huge concern. And so when I worked at the T, I left 5 years ago, we would never do diversions like this during Red Sox season, for instance, if there were a major homestand, or if the Celtics, for instance, were in the playoffs, go Celtics, not to mention major tourism events. So yes, but unfortunately, because we have had now 30, 35 years of deferred maintenance on the system, we have to do this work to catch up. And it's really unfortunate. We cannot do 35 years of deferred maintenance in one summer, or even 1 month, or even 2 summers or 2 months. It's going to take a long time. And I feel terrible for tourists. We need to do a lot better job out there, especially in other languages, to let our visitors know that that the system is here and where they should be going. But unfortunately, it has to happen. We've let it go for too long, and we have to do it. And it is going to hurt our local businesses, and it's going to hurt our tourism economy, and it's going to hurt folks going to sports games. Unfortunately, it has to happen.
So, I mean, it has to happen. I hear that message loud and clear. But, Stacey, a question for you. Do you think the T is effectively communicating to riders those goals to improve future service? The whole, like, pay now, gain later. Are riders open to that message? Are you skeptical? Are they skeptical?
So I think that there are sort of two things going on here. There has been a marked improvement in communication between administrations, right? So there was almost no information coming out of the Baker administration around the diversions. We are now seeing, more of a heads up for the public. The general manager has been clear. You know, he's getting out there saying, hey, this is what we're thinking over the next couple of months. That is better than we were a few months ago. Having said that, do I think the general public understands what the goals are or what's going on? No. Yeah. It is very complicated, right? And I think what's particularly challenging about the kind of work that is happening now is that it's the kind of stuff that when well-maintained, you never see and you never think about it. And it might not make service feel better right away, right? So they might shut down a portion of rail for evenings or weekends in order to improve safety, in order to make it function better. But that might not feel different to the everyday rider. But it's really, really critical, right? It's like taking your car in for basic maintenance. It's like basic roadway maintenance. It's these things that we're very used to that we just haven't been doing appropriately. So I think it's a hard message to communicate, but I do think it is absolutely critical that the T improve the way that they communicate about this. I'd also note the Sumner Tunnel is going to be closed for 2 months over the summer, and everyone is focused on the T, but I think we're really going to test the T in July and August in particular, because we're going to need to have the T functioning enough to move some people off of 1A, to move some people from the North Shore onto the system. So I think we have an opportunity to actually see if we're making improvements, if we're effectively communicating, but we've got a long way to go.
Oh, we've got a long way to go. And I had to remind myself of like that long-term investment coming to Boston at 11 p.m., delirious, wanting to go home and not finding the red line. So I just had to remind myself it's for the good of us all. But this is all happening under the new TGM, Philip Ng. He's been on the job for a little under a month now. Does this strategy to prioritize track work feel like an early hallmark of Ng's managerial style? Or is the situation so dire that any leader that could have been appointed to this position would do the same exact thing? Brian?
Well, I think he is doing the right thing. And yes, it had to be done, as I've said before. So Mr. Ng walked into a capital program, an infrastructure program that was basically already in place, as well as an operating budget that's basically already in place. So he doesn't have tons of influence on those two things right now. I think we'll really start to see his influence in the coming months. But I think he is the right hire. He has a project management background, an engineering background, and I'm so excited that he's here, and I think the governor made a great hire in Mr. Ng.
Stacey, do you want to weigh in on how you think Ng is doing, or how do you think he will do?
Yeah, I think he's had a good first month. There's only so much you can do in a month, but he has been on the system a lot, and he's been out in the field a lot. We've seen him at bus maintenance facilities. We've seen him actually getting his hands dirty. There's been a lot of criticism of people at high-level positions positions, living in different places. And I think he's showing a very different managerial approach by taking the tea to work and physically showing up where the work happens. So I think that's a positive sign that he's interested in that kind of management. I would also say we can't forget that we are still in the middle of responding to the FTA investigation. So to a certain extent, we have no choice. We do have to, you know, some of the work that the tea is prioritizing is in direct response to what the federal government told us we must do in order to, you know, avoid losing funding, potential takeover, et cetera. So to a certain extent, the playbook was put in front of him by our partners in the federal government, at least for the first few months of his tenure.
I do want to talk about another Governor Healey appointment to the T. So that's Patrick Lavin, Chief Safety Officer at the State Department of Transportation. We know that passenger safety is vital. You just mentioned the FTA report to the future of the T. So is Lavin the right man for the job, do you think, Stacey?
Lavin literally wrote the safety report for the MBTA.
There you go.
It's a little bit.
He knows at least what he's up against.
There's maybe no one who knows more about the safety challenges of the MBTA walking in the door on day one. It's not just that he read the report. He literally wrote the report, and he has decades of experience. I think what's interesting about this position is that it sits in the DOT, not at the MBTA, and that it's a sort of statewide safety purview. So I'm actually curious what he's going to do beyond the MBTA. We also had a record number of roadway crashes this year. There are a variety of other ways that you can think about transportation safety in the state. So, of course, he's the right pick for the MBTA, but I'm very curious to see how he builds out this new role in a department whose responsibility is not just the MBTA, but the MBTA, the 15 regional transit authorities, and the roads and bridges across the state.
A woman was injured at Harvard Station yesterday. So this is more on safety. When a brace that supported a utility box fell and hit her. So this happened 2 months after a ceiling panel fell at that same station. It narrowly missed hitting someone. I freaked out when I saw that video. I don't know if you have. It went viral a little bit. But I want to know, Brian, starting with you, like, what are your reactions when you see things like this?
I think the natural reaction is outrage. How can this be allowed to happen? So, you know, the T has inspecting teams and it has safety teams. It has track walkers. It has folks that are supposed to be out inspecting tunnels and stations and busways and all of that sort of passenger-facing infrastructure overnight, every night, when the system isn't running. Are these folks doing their job? I have to assume they are, but we keep seeing these infrastructure failures over and over and over again. And I think people really are starting to question confidence in the system. Now, I ride the system every day. I have confidence in it. My family's on it. I think it is safe. But it's also very natural for folks to start to question that and wonder, what is going on? Is anyone managing anything at the T these days? Mr. Eng's been there a month, and I really think it's time for him to get stuck in and start really asking these tough questions.
Stacey, I really want to bring this into context and why we're talking about all of these issues, because, you know, not everyone is a T rider, and I get that. But I want to bring in a listener comment that really highlights this. So Abby in Dorchester says, pre-pandemic, my red line commute took 30 to 45 minutes each way. Now it takes 90. And so my husband and I scramble to get home, get our kid, make dinner, shorten window. That leaves no time for connection or relaxation. It impacts our lives. I'm very bitter that there has been no accountability for anyone involved in this mess. So basically she says they're telling us that this is not important. This is a quality of life issue.
Yeah. Yeah. And this, I do not disagree. Red line riders in particular. So let me back up. You can go on the T's website right now and look at where the slow zones are and look at the kind of slow zone. Is it below 10 miles an hour? Is it 10 to 15? The red line has the most and the slowest of the slow zones. So it's really bad, and it's a very long line. So what this listener is describing is a real experience for thousands of red line riders every single day. Having said that, I do think this is a moment where we have to talk about the legislature and the governor. I was very openly critical of Charlie Baker's management of the MBTA, but equal criticism goes to the legislature. We have known for many years that the MBTA is underfunded. We have known for many years that these problems are coming. They are publicly reported to the board of directors. They are reported on radio and newspapers for years. And the legislature has said, not it, not it. We're not going to talk about it. And so this is not just a question of Eng or the governor, but the person that you have voted for as your state rep. If they are not fighting for more funding right now, they are saying, I'm okay with you spending that much time on a train. And that is where I think the core, the hard part, the money conversation of our challenges is.
We're talking about the MBTA with Livable Streets Executive Director Stacey Thompson and MBTA Advisory Board Executive Director Brian Kane. But I want to bring in another voice. Andrea Perdomo Hernandez is WBUR's transportation reporter. Andrea, welcome.
Hey, Yasmin.
Hi. So I need to ask you about a recent piece of yours that just really surprised me and kind of made me uneasy. It's detailing concerns with the MBTA's pension fund. Tell us what the problem is and how big it is.
So we got our hands on an arbitration filing between the T and its biggest labor union, right? And the document reveals that the system's troubled pension fund is actually in worse state than previously reported. One of the big things that I took away from that report is that the fund is actually paying out more in benefits than it's taking in. Some meeting minutes show that the pension fund pays out like $5 to $6 million more per month than it takes in, and that puts the T in a very precarious, puts the pension fund in a very precarious situation.
And you said in the report that means it could become, the system could become insolvent. If more money goes out than in, it could become insolvent by 2038.
That's correct. So in that document, the T's financial chief, Marianne O'Hara, said that this current trajectory, right, could lead the T to become insolvent or a.k.a. broke, by 2038.
Money.
No money.
So your report that the T's retirement age is actually 55. Relative to contemporary American retirement norms, that seems young.
So the T and the union have been discussing multiple things to kind of get to their new agreement, and that was one of the things that was on the table. If people are retiring at 55, the concern is that people are pulling from the pension fund for longer, right? So that doesn't help the financial situation.
And I want to ask you, do they have to stick with that retirement age, but they feel like they can't change that because they're having such a tough time recruiting workers?
So one of the pushbacks from the union, like from that agreement, was that, like, you know, if we change this rule now, like you have people that have been working for, almost 20 years and we go ahead and change that rule on them now, that is going to create like disarray, like it's going to create an uproar within the people that are working, the people that they already have. And then it'll make the T even less appealing to the people that they're trying to recruit. As you know, that there's like some 2,000 plus job positions that, the T is trying to fill. So,
which is a lot.
Yes.
It's a lot. But Andrea, you're sticking with us, but I also want to bring in, so we're talking about the T. We have with us Andrea Perdomo Hernandez and also Brian Kane, Executive Director, MBTA Advisory Board, Stacey Thompson, Executive Director of Livable Streets. So, Brian, you just heard Andrea talk about, the 55 retirement age for the T was something that the union had negotiated. I wonder if there are currently conversations happening around that retirement age.
Not that I'm aware of. There used to be no retirement age. There was no age limit. After you worked 23 years, you could retire, which is to begin to access your pension, no matter what your age was. So there used to be folks at 43 or 44 who started working there at 18 and could retire. But I think it's also important to note that there are many positions at the T that are very dangerous, that involve working with 600 volts of electricity, that involve working in tunnels. These are not the easiest jobs in the world. So I think it's important that we don't vilify the T employees here who have a retirement system.
Yeah.
The T, like any employer, makes a contribution to their employees' retirements. The employees themselves also make contributions. That goes into a fund called the Retirement Fund, and that invests money and then pays out people's pensions over time. So it's not like this money is coming from the T's operating budget directly. The pension has been an issue for many years. And I understand that folks get very animated about it. But honestly, 2038, there's bigger issues facing the T that that it faces insolvency much sooner than that. We're looking at a giant fiscal deficit starting in 2025, for instance. So while the pension thing is certainly a concern, it's something my organization is very worried about, there's also significant financial issues facing us sooner than 2038.
Oof. Andrea, back to you. How could the pension fund issue affect the T's future? And do you think the agency has a plan yet to avoid the most dire consequences?
So I haven't seen any plan as of yet. But to Brian's point, the T is facing multiple financial battles, right? So looking at the pension fund alone, right, 2038 looks like, you know, doomsday year or whatever. But sooner than that, the T is also facing like financial viability questionability, right, as soon as like a year or two, because of their operating costs and ridership being low. Right now, ridership's like at 61% of the levels that it was pre-pandemic. So the T's having a hard time just getting revenue to keep up with the costs. So there's multiple things that are happening at the same time. So for me, I was just kind of surprised, like, oh no, it's not just the operating, you know, it's not just operating costs. Oh no, it's not just the pension. It's like these things happening at the same time.
Mm. And Stacey, I wonder if you want to weigh in, because we, you know, we spent the last segment talking about all these things that they have to do. Like, there's just no choice if you want a viable system. But then we have to talk about money and how to pay for all that. So,
yeah, you know, I would just echo that. I think it's really important to not focus short term on just the pension or try to blame the workers. Mm-hmm. You know, it's actually quite common for there to be a lower retirement age for blue collar work, because that work breaks your body down. It is higher risk. And so I think people want to point to that and say, oh, just make everyone retire at 65 and we've solved our problem. Underlying this is a need to recruit thousands of people. but underlying this is a need to keep those people working in the system. So I think that there are a lot of different things going on with this particular issue that is tied to hiring. But if you actually sit down and look at the operating budget, again, we've known this for a long time, the T has been saddled with debt. They still hold big debt, which I think surprises people. That was sort of given to them. Brett, this is a bee in our bonnets, which we could totally have a separate segment about. So they have this enormous amount of debt that was put on them. They also have this pension challenge, and that's all coming out of the operating budget. That's all coming out of the budget that's, again, meant to pay for workers, meant to pay for the people who are walking through Harvard Station every day, making sure it's safe. And so it's this looking at the sort of impact of debt and impact of the pension and underfunding the operating budget is very much a canary in the coal mine for how we should be thinking of this much bigger fiscal crisis that we are all, that is, again, you can find it on the internet. This is not a surprise, and our legislature needs to deal with it.
So I just want to clarify maybe like a stance that that both of you take. So is raising the retirement age, like, should we even think about it? Is it one of the options? Like, do you think it's one of the smart options? Or because what I'm hearing you both say is that that's a superficial issue. And we need to think about how to actually like bring more money into that pension fund. So like, would you raise the retirement age?
Yeah, I would not start with raising the retirement age for blue collar workers, right? There are many pensions that treat white collar workers and blue collar workers different because of the physical impacts of the work. And the reality is some folks cannot work until they're 65 based on the type of work that they have, or safely and maintain a healthy body. There are just other things that you can do to make a pension system solvent, including, you know, enticing folks to work for the system, which is the first step that we need to see happen.
What about you, Brian? Raise the retirement age or no?
I mean, I haven't looked at this, the data in a while, but when I last looked, the average pension for an MBTA retiree was around $45,000 a year. And these things tended not to grow. So the money that you retire with is what you sort of get for the rest of your natural life. So I don't think that pensions are the biggest issue facing the T right now. I would not raise the retirement age, as Stacey said, for the blue-collar folks, for the folks that are out there working, driving buses and trains, trying to splice 600 volts of electricity on a nightly basis. No. Mm. Maybe for some of the more executive-type folks, kind of doing the job that I used to do, where I wasn't exposed to these potential hazards every day, I think that's certainly something that should be looked at, yes.
So I'm going to turn to Andrea because I want to ask you about another piece, so I'm shifting to another topic with the T. Another recent piece of yours was a report about the Worcester Regional Transit Authority. They're extending a program that makes buses free. I mean, we're talking about money and we're talking about, you know, a lack of money, but at the same time, there are programs to try to make bus fares free. So how did that program come about and how is it being paid for?
So the WRTA, they suspended, you know, fare collection like many other authorities in March 2020 at the start of the pandemic. And since then, the authority's advisory board has been voting every couple months to extend it. And the most recent time that they did this vote was just last month. And the authority's advisory board voted unanimously to extend free fares through 2024. And just to be like kind of clear, they're not like making it free and like there's like no money covering, you know, like they're covering the cost of fares through another means, right? So in this particular case, they're using COVID fares, COVID relief funds.
Federal COVID relief funds.
Yes. Gotcha. CARES Act money to cover the cost of fares. So, you know, the authority administrator, Dennis Lipka, he told WBUR that there is enough of these relief funds to kind of cover the cost of these fares, you know, for the next couple of years. But after that, they're going to be looking for a way to get money to cover that cost if they want to keep this program going.
And quickly, like, what do people argue about why we need free fares?
So I spoke with one longtime like WRTA writer who's also a member of the Zero Fare Coalition of over in Worcester. Her name's Lynn Norris, and she has been writing the system for like 20 plus years. And she says that not only did like removing fares from like the equation of things that she needed to worry about was like an extreme relief during the pandemic, but it helps her just get everywhere easier, right? Like she doesn't have to like worry about if she has enough fare to go to the grocery store and then go pick up her medications. She can just go outside and like get on the bus whenever she needs to go wherever it is that she needs to go. So it's a tremendous relief and it helps her get around way easier.
Can I bring you both back in? Stacey Thompson, Executive Director of Livable Streets. Thoughts on free fares?
Yes. I mean, we, for the last few years, have been vocally supportive of making all buses in the state free. So that would include the 15 regional transit authorities that are all bus-only systems and all of the local buses in the MBTA system. And it's exactly, you know, reflective of what we're seeing in Worcester. For context, Worcester's ridership is up by 140% of their 2019 levels. So that means that they haven't just recovered from COVID. They are bucking the downward ridership trends that we saw in 2017, 2018, 2019. Merrimack Valley, that has also gone fare-free, is also bucking those trends. And they've been able to improve the system's performance on very high ridership lines. Because people can get in and out of both doors of the bus very quickly without paying fares, it can speed up service so much that you can run an additional trip on a line without purchasing more buses or hiring more operators.
Yeah.
So it is a, you know, people look at the cost, but we look at the savings related to fare free, which are substantial.
Brian, I'd love to hear your thoughts quickly about what you think about the free fare proposal.
Well, you know, as a former operating person, it's those system improvements that really fascinate me, which the City of Boston pilot on the Route 28 proved. You can really speed up service. You can make it much easier to run more trips. And this is what the T needs to do right now, especially in an era of slow zones on rails. We need to figure out ways to speed up bus trips, whether it's dedicated lanes, whether it's transit signal priority, or whether it's doing things like reducing dwell time by not having to spend so much time stopped to collect fares. So that's where our focus is right now, is figuring out ways that the T can speed up service. And this is certainly one of them. And I also, we should really point out here that the T has also embarked on a really large fare transformation project that's costing billions, that really needs a hard look as well.
Lots to talk. I could talk to you all hour about the T. It is a topic I definitely feel passionate about. But Brian Kane, Executive Director of the MBTA Advisory Board, Stacey Thompson, Executive Director of Livable Streets, and our own Andrea Perdomo-Hernandez, WBUR's transportation reporter, thank you all for being here to talk about the MBTA.
Thank you.
Thanks, Yasmin.
Thank you.
We're approaching the 2-month mark with legalized sports betting in Massachusetts, and it's brought in big money so far, to the tune of more than $500 million. Then again, maybe not so surprising because you're likely seeing ads like this everywhere.
Dave told me you got some kind of great system for betting that really works.
That's true.
What is it? Is it like home dogs? No, 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 no. It's bird mascots.
No, I just use FanDuel's responsible gaming tools like time and spending limits to manage my play.
That's the system.
Hasn't failed me yet.
Responsible gaming, they say. But is that actually possible? Many experts have warned that we don't have enough guardrails in place to protect people from predatory sports gambling. So here to talk more about that, we're joined today by Harry Levant. He's an internationally certified gambling counselor and mental health therapist, and he runs the gambling treatment program with Ethos Treatment in Philadelphia. Also a doctoral student of law and policy at Northeastern University. Harry, thank you so much for joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
We're also joined in the studio by Les Bernal, the national director of the nonprofit group Stop Predatory Gambling. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
And Harry, I do want to start with you because you've been vocal about the dangers of legal sports betting in Massachusetts since then-Governor Charlie Baker first legalized it back in August last year. So what have you seen since and since mobile betting was introduced just last month?
Well, it's a pleasure to be on with my friend and colleague Les from Stop Predatory Gambling. And there are some facts, you know, hard scientific facts that we know. Gambling is an addictive product. Gambling is an addictive product on the same level as heroin, opioids, tobacco, cocaine. What has now happened is that the state of Massachusetts, 32 other states, and the District of Columbia have legalized a known addictive product. But it's much worse than that, because we're dealing with what we call the gambling establishment. This is a partnership between state government, gambling companies, professional collegiate sports leagues and teams, the players' associations themselves, the largest media companies in the world, and technology, which delivers access to a known addictive product constantly and immediately. So if you have access to a known addictive product without guardrails, significant public harm inexorably will follow.
And you just mentioned so many stakeholders that are extremely powerful who are all somewhat benefiting from this. Not somewhat, a lot.
Not somewhat. They all have. And yeah. I've written articles on this. I've been published in the Globe on this. You've just hit on a crucial issue. Government has become a full partner with private industry to make money promoting a known addictive product. And the model with gambling is that the faster you can deliver that product to the public for consumption, the more money all of these stakeholders make. That is inherently a problem. And that's what the gambling industry and its establishment partners mean when they use the word responsible gaming, words responsible gaming. Let us do what we want as much and as often as we want, and we will shift the onus on the individual to make responsible decisions.
Well, let me bring in Les real quick, because I want to know also, Les, like what it's been like for you to watch this unfold as a Massachusetts resident.
Sure. So I'm from Lawrence, Mass. So I think, you know, it was nice to come in here to the studio and talk about this. To me, this issue represents America's biggest, most neglected major problem, and that is, you know, predatory gambling is America's, it's the public voice of American government today to citizens across our country, especially here in Massachusetts. So what your listeners need to understand, like what makes commercialized gambling like online sports gambling different than any other business in the country, including other vices like alcohol and tobacco, is there's an adversarial relationship between the gambling operator and the gambler. So the gambling operator only wins, the state government only wins if citizens lose immensely. And just to put a number on this, this is right out of the United Kingdom, which is the same kind of companies. The same companies are operating in the UK and now in the US. 86% of online gambling profits were coming from 5% of the gamblers. So we're not just talking about a mildly addictive product. We're not talking about a mildly predatory business. Like, this is, again, arguably the most neglected problem in America today. And to put a number on it in the big picture, if you add up all the money that citizens are losing in Massachusetts to the lottery, to the regional casinos, and online gambling, it exceeds $2.6 billion a year. So in the course of this 20-minute conversation, the citizens of Massachusetts, that boils down to $5,000 a minute citizens of Massachusetts in the next 20 minutes, they're going to lose $100,000 in the course of this conversation of their personal wealth to government-sanctioned gambling, to predatory gambling.
Oof. Thanks for putting that in context. But let's bring in back Harry, because this is a very personal issue for you. Could you talk more about that?
I'd be happy to. I just celebrated the nine-year anniversary of my last bet. I made my last bet on April 27th, 2014. On that same night, I nearly took my own life in a suicide attempt. I was a pathological compulsive gambler, struggling in the grips of a gambling addiction that harmed not only me, it harmed my children, I was a lawyer, it harmed my clients. I stole money from anyone, anything I could get my hands on, because gambling addiction is not about money. It's about the way the product makes you feel. It gives you a high, a sense of action for the person struggling with gambling addiction. And as with any other addiction or any other addictive product, a person who's struggling with addiction will do whatever it takes to get their hands on their product or their fix. And with gambling, that means you have to find access to money. And what we're going to see in Massachusetts is what we've seen in every other state that legalizes online gambling. You're going to see an increase in financial crime. You're going to see an increase in mental health problems. You're going to see an increase in risk of suicide. One out of every two people who struggle with gambling contemplate suicide, and one out of every five make a suicide attempt. I'm sorry, did I cut you off?
No. I do want to say, if you or anyone you know is experiencing thoughts of suicide or struggling with mental health-related issues, you can call 988. That's the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. So thank you so much for sharing that with us. But I do want to know, like, when was that moment for you where the light bulb went off and you decided that you needed help?
When I was trying to write a suicide note to explain to my children that which could never actually be explained. It's difficult to put into words exactly how unwell I was at that time on April 27, 2014. I was extraordinarily impaired. A lot of people in recovery talk about having a moment of clarity. I had one as I was trying to write a note to explain this to my children. And I realized that I didn't want to die. My addiction wanted me to die. It was done with me. Mm-hmm. It would move on to someone else. I would be gone. And I picked up the phone and I called for help. And interestingly, what happened in that phone call informed the journey that brings me here today to have the privilege to speak with you and Les and all of your listeners.
Have you seen an uptick in people now coming to you for help with sports gambling addiction?
It's not about me, not to me personally, but in every state, we are seeing enormous, enormous increases in the number of calls to gambling helplines. The system for getting help is fundamentally flawed in this country. This is part of what the problem with this responsible gaming model is. The gambling industry actually attempts to play a role in how treatment is delivered, and we could go on an entire other show about that.
Oh, yeah.
In fact, when I called for help, one of the things I was told was, we work with the gambling industry to help them spot people who have gambling problems. This is part of the illusion of this responsible gaming model, and it's why...
I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but I do want to bring Les in, because I do want to hear your thoughts about this whole idea of responsible gambling. And I know probably legally they have to put this in all of their ads, but I want to know what that phrase means to you, and does it actually prevent harm?
Yeah, the whole concept of responsible gambling is a sham. You know, what we have here in America when it comes to state governments like Massachusetts pushing these extreme forms of predatory gambling, where we said earlier the business model is based on gambling addiction. 86% of the profits are coming from 5% of the gamblers. This is a government program. So what we have here is a system of taxation by exploitation. You know, our country's founded on the principle, one of the core principles, no taxation without representation. Well, taxation by exploitation has been occurring in Massachusetts for 40 years, this newest form, like I'm from Lawrence, they're selling $50 lottery scratch tickets at check cashing stores in the poorest community in the state. So the idea that somehow this is regulated to protect people, that they've been talking about responsible gambling for 40 years, it's a con. Okay, the whole thing is a public con to give opinion leaders and you know your listeners who most of whom probably don't gamble. Oh, they think there's some kind of protections in place. It gives the appearance that somehow people are being protected. The business model is based on exploitation of citizens of Massachusetts. And the last key point, you all your listeners understand, like what's happening here. You know what happened to Harry and what's happening right now. This is we're unleashing an epidemic of child gambling across Massachusetts. Like I'm watching Fenway Park. They got MGM's logo on the emblazoned painted on the green monster.
Yeah, I do. Just like speaking on that, one of the big concerns with mobile sports betting in particular is how easily young people can access it. So we talked last month with sports psychologist Gerald Reed, and this is what he had to say.
Well, it doesn't seem like it's going to get any better the more pervasive it becomes. You know, there's even high school students gambling, like in class. I hear about it. You know, they got their phones out. They're like, oh, I just made a bet, you know, and they're not even of legal age to do that.
So I couldn't help but you heard me gasping in that because that just that was such a visceral reaction when I hear that high school students are sitting here and betting money. So how often have you heard about that?
It's all over the country.
If I may,
isn't even just the situations where people under the age of 21 are betting. It's worse than that. It's the normalization of the product to children. Yeah. You couldn't watch last night's Boston Celtics, Philadelphia 76ers basketball game without being inundated with gambling within the game. You can't go to a baseball game, whether it's looking at it on the green monster, in all of the arenas, in every broadcast. It's being normalized in a way through what we call micro betting, where and this is what the state and its gambling partners call responsible gaming.
Micro betting, as in just like every step of the game.
Every single shot.
You could bet like 50 times in one game. But can I actually just bring in Les real quick, because you said it's everywhere, and I hear you both that it's you know it's an issue that you just. You said this whole idea of responsible gaming does not exist, but what can exist? What protections can exist?
Yeah, well, when you have a product, as we've said earlier, where 86% of the profits are coming from 5% of the people that use it, you know, some products are so dangerous, like it shouldn't be allowed. Like we would say, you know, there's no grassroots movement for online sports gambling in Massachusetts. People weren't pounding the table saying, I want this in my kid's bedroom or in my office. This is driven by very powerful corporate gambling interests, you know, driven by greed and a handful of public officials who lust for more political power. That's what this is driven about. Most of whom, by the way, don't gamble themselves. On the homepage of our website, we have this phenomenon we call the Hypocrite Hall of Fame. And over the last 15 years since I've been in this work, on the Hypocrite Hall of Fame, we have a list of governors, casino executives, state legislators, and so on, who stand up and cheerlead, you know, for casinos for your town. They run they promote the lottery, the cheerlead DraftKings. You know, the guys that founded DraftKings. All they promote gambling. It's great for your family, but I don't gamble myself. I'm not, quote unquote, I'm not a gambler, and that's why it's a con. The whole thing from the get go is a ripoff of the people of Massachusetts, and it's costing people $5,000 a minute, and it's causing immense human suffering for tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Massachusetts citizens because of how addictive it is.
If you are just joining us, we are talking with Les Bernal, National Director of Stop Predatory Gambling, and Harry Levant, Gambling Addiction Counselor and doctoral student at Northeastern University. We're talking about the dangers of gambling addiction. And my burning question to you, and I'll start with you, Harry, do you see a future for legalized sports gambling, or is this something that we made a mistake in legalizing it?
There are a lot of layers to that question. When the Supreme Court cleared the way for states to do this back in the Murphy case in 2018, Justice Alito wrote that Congress is free to regulate sports gambling. It's a matter of public policy. It's not for me to say whether it's going to continue. It certainly looks like it's going to continue, but there needs to be huge overhaul at the federal level to regulate this industry. States have shown a complete unwillingness to act. Fortunately, in Massachusetts, we do have Senator Keenan, who is leading an effort to address gambling advertising, and Congressman Tonko in New York is leading a national effort to ban gambling advertising with his bill in Congress. But there needs to be a major, if it's going to continue, there needs to be a major overhaul that replaces responsible gaming with a public health regulatory approach. That's what my research at Northeastern is all about. That's what I advocate for. This is not an issue of responsibility.
Yeah.
The state and the gambling companies have shown they can't behave responsibly. This is a question of public health on a national level.
Is it fair to say that you can't discount it altogether before you see really serious ways in which we actually take this seriously as a public health issue?
The evidence is already there. Les has cited much of it. The anecdotal evidence, I see it every day in my practice at Ethos Treatment here in Philadelphia. The evidence is everywhere. The media is not covering it well enough. The media's partners in this. They're part of the gambling establishment. But there is already blood in the streets. The question is, when are people going to begin to talk about it? And conversations like the one Les and I are having are important.
Well, Harry Levant, gambling addiction counselor, doctoral student of law and policy at Northeastern University, thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure.
And Les Bernal, National Director of Stop Predatory Gambling. I really appreciate you being here as well. Thank you so much. That is our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Yasmeen Ammer. Join us again for more Radio Boston tomorrow.